years ago, and it was a spring day, much like a spring day that we had on Tuesday. Remember how Tuesday was this week? I even got the old khaki shorts out. Tuesday was nice. Nice spring day, and I was at home with my grandparents. I stayed home in their home. And I did a lot of that spring. I was a 20-year-old kid, and it was a Saturday. And my granddad Blaine and I had a whole day together. And I'll never forget what that moment was like with him. And in that particular spring, I did a lot of turkey hunting out there, fished on the farm, hunted mushrooms, and shot my .22 rifle. It was a good spring in that respect, in being on their farm. And Granddad and I had been out that day, likely fishing. I don't know what we were doing in particular. I don't believe I had a car at that time because my dad took my car. And I'll share with you why that was. But I can still remember heading back to the house, from Granddad's house, and the smell of that S10 pickup. I could smell the gasoline in that S10 pickup. I could smell the fish smell we had on us. And I could still smell the stale cigarette smoke and the upholstery of the seats and the fresh cigarette my granddad had in his mouth. It was just that clear to me, driving down that gravel road headed back to my grandfather's place. I could still feel the warmth of that new spring breeze coming into the cab of that pickup, and I was wearing a cutoff t-shirt in those days, and the breeze wafting through my shirt. And Granddad's nervous voice cut through the silence that day as we was driving back, and his nervous voice said this: "So, Jeff, when you and Stephanie are going to get back together?" And now my granddad and grandpa were doing something that spring that the rest of my family had a really hard time doing. And I don't blame them. It was showing compassion. You see, to be sure, at that time period, I was a very selfish jerk. And I didn't have any inkling at all to grow my relationship to Jesus Christ. And looking back, I thought I was a Christian. Knowing now what I know about Jesus and my relationship with him, that had I died in that season, my soul would have very much ended in all of eternity in hell. But my grandparents were clued into that. My parents were also clued into it, and my family. My family wanted nothing to do with me in that season. Steph and I were separated. I was barely making it in a dumpy old apartment in Kirksville. But my grandparents showed me compassion. I don't remember how I got out that spring to their house because my dad said, "You know, you're driving my car. You're not living the life that I want you to live. The car's now mine." And I don't recall what if my grandparents came, got me or whatever, but I was there at their house. But that spring, I remember ice cream, rhubarb crisp, rhubarb jam, and just sitting around a table of two people who were desperately disappointed in their grandson, but willing to love me. Willing to love me. And so they treated me with compassion. And Granddad showed me compassion on that particular day when he fought through his nervousness and he asked me that tough question, and it helped me answer in a way that I thought I could answer. And my answer was, "Granddad, I think we'll get back together. I think we'll get back together." And so they were the only people in that season of my sin-filled life that were willing to show me compassion. And a thought to me occurred is this: when you receive compassion, guess what you can give? You can give compassion. When you know you've received it, you can give it. And the Christ-like compassion that my grandparents showed me that day shaped my life to who I am even today and how I treat people. And so listen to these synonyms of compassion. There's sympathy, empathy, concern, kindness, consideration, care, kind-heartedness. The antonym of compassion is cold-heartedness. It's cold-heartedness. Max Lucado quotes an author named Annie Lamott. And Annie Lamott was not a Christian. She became a Christian. I want to share more about her story later. But she said this about a man who helped her come to know Jesus. She said, "He was about the first Christian I ever met whom I could stand to be in the same room with. Most Christians seemed almost hostile in their belief that they were saved and you weren't." That struck me. How many people who aren't a nationally known author think of us Christians like that? In our workplace, in our community, or even in our churches and our homes, they show up around us and they feel the same way around us. And I'm concerned about that. And Jesus was very clear about it. Jesus expects his followers to be what? compassionate. He expects that. That's an expectation, is to be compassionate. It's not wish I could have, should have. No, that's an expectation. And Jesus expects his followers to have sympathy, empathy, concern, kindness, consideration, caring, and kind-heartedness to how many people? All people. That's how Jesus expects that of us as Christians. And so I found myself in a predicament a number of years ago. I became a Christian 20 years ago this spring. And when I became that Christian 20 years ago this spring, I found myself in a predicament. The predicament was I was doing all the right Christian things. I could go to church, and I could pick up a hymn book, and I could remember the hymns I used to sing when I was a kid. I could read a Bible. I could get up early and have Bible study. I could do all those things and be the Christian person that I felt God had called me to be. But yet something was happening. I was curt. I was a grouch. I was irritable. I couldn't find myself getting along with people who didn't do faith like me. It bothered me when you don't do faith like me. And I began to realize something about me. I felt worse when I became a Christian. Felt worse. Any idea why? I thought I had a list to make every day as a Christian. I thought I had a list to make every single day. I thought I'm not living a very good Christian life because I'm supposed to do this, I'm supposed to do this, I'm supposed to do this, I'm supposed to do this. And when you're supposed to do something, guess how you're supposed to feel? You're supposed to feel good, but I wasn't feeling good. And so I chose to accept guilt. I chose to accept guilt because I wasn't living the Christian life that I was supposed to live. By the way, folks, guilt throws a party every day. Don't accept the invitation. Unless, of course, you're in sin. And so I was focused on doing the things a Christian was supposed to do to please God. But I want to encourage you something. There's something different to focus on. Instead of that, you see, most of us Christians consider ourselves Christians because of what we do. And we have this list of things that we're supposed to do. But the problem is, we're not focused on who we are or whose we are. That's the problem. And I began to feel bad about that because I didn't feel like I was making the life that God designed for me to live. So what does God desire of me to be and not necessarily do? Did you find your Bibles in Matthew 9? Matthew 9, okay. Matthew 9, verses 9 through 13. We're reading through the book of Matthew this year together. Matthew 9, 9 through 13, here it is. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew stay at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him. Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw all this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus says, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy. And some translations say what? Compassion, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. And so, any idea what the Pharisees were known for? What are the Pharisees known for? Oh, legalism. They were known for getting it right. Okay, they were known for having everything together. When these guys showed up in the synagogue, what we would call a church, everybody looked up to them because they had it right. And they looked down on everybody else who wasn't doing life like they were. They were called spiritual snots. Spiritual snots and snobs. That's what they're called, spiritual snots and snobs. And any time that you look down on people who aren't doing faith like you do, guess what you are? You're a snob. That's exactly what you are. You're a spiritual snob. You're a spiritual snob. And these guys are doing this, just that. And in verse 18 of Matthew 9, we're going to see, I'm not going to read it, but in verse 18, there's a man that comes up to Jesus who has the potential and likely could be a spiritual snob, that he's desperate. He's desperate for his little girl to be healed. And he falls down, and some translations say this, he falls down in worship of Jesus right there. And Jesus, in the next 30 verses, shares with us what it means to be compassionate to at least five people in the next 30 verses. And that excites me. And I'm not going to get to that today. And I would really desire for you to have the time to go through that yourself. But this really sets us up for Matthew 10. I'm not sure about you, but I'm a list person. Is anybody else a list person? List person, where you write things down. Sometimes you write things down. You want to get accomplished. You write them down. And you like to check them off, right? List people? Have we got any reformed list people here? Okay, great, great. We got some. Okay, here we go. I love lists. And sometimes as a Christian life, when I first became a Christian, I just wanted a list to live a life by. And I lived by that list, and I became an embittered person. But Jesus shares with us something. In Matthew 10, he gives us a list of what it looks like to live as a Christian, but he first shows us how to be compassionate. And friends, this is very important for us to remember. There's a wonderful spiritual truth here as far as these two chapters go, okay? Listen, and it's this. Without compassion, you cannot be the Christian God desires. You can't do it. Without compassion, you can't be the Christian God desires. And we can even further say this truth as well. To be a Christian is to be compassionate. Merciful is to be a compassionate person. And so as we step into Matthew 10, we're going to see how Jesus is calling us to be the Christian he designs us to be with a list, but he shows us compassion first. It sets up for us on how to be and how to do. Number one is this. Compassion is learned through suffering, just like Jesus. Compassion is learned through suffering. If you follow along your bulletin outline, you're going to see how to fill in that blank today. Now, in Matthew 10, starting in verse 24, a student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the student to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. If the head of the household has been called Beelzebub, how much more the members of his household? Now, first of all, we need to understand something. Jesus has been called Beelzebub. Beelzebub means Lord of the Dung Heap. Lord of the Dung Heap. They've called Jesus what? Beelzebub. They've called him that. They've called him that. So let me ask you a quick question based on these two verses. Look at the verses again. Did Jesus suffer while he was on earth? Yes. Okay, thank you. Is Jesus your teacher? Yes. Is Jesus your master? Yes to both. Then as Christians, I should expect what? I should expect some type of suffering for my faith. I should expect that. To expect that any differently is foolish, okay? So let's put this another way. If you haven't received any slack from being a follower of Christ, it might be wise to ask what question? Am I really a follower of Christ if I have not received slack? And all that, but it's our desire. Paul said in Philippians 3, let's read this together. I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings. This is our desire as Christians. And so this week in your quiet time, you know what? You get six questions this week for the sermon time. Isn't that amazing? Six questions. 6 days this week you can ask the same different question. Here it is. Let's read this together. Jesus, I want to know you more deeply. How does suffering make me compassionate like you? Question two is this. Compassion is developed by fearing God, not who? Not people. Fearing God, not people. Look in verse 26. Jesus goes on to say, so do not be afraid of them. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that you will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but who cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Now look, if you choose to follow Jesus Christ and truly love him, you should expect what? Suffering. You should expect that. People will not like you. I think it's wise to try to accept that early on in your Christian faith. Maybe you're late in your faith. You still haven't got that concept right. Get it right now. You must decide now what you're going to do when people don't like you because of your relationship with Jesus. And if you look in verse 26, how many things are going to be revealed in verse 26? All things. So your behavior, it's all going to be what? It's going to be revealed in some time. Verse 27, Jesus says, hey, look, you have a relationship with me. What I share with you in secret, this is what I want you to do. What's he want you to do? Share it. Don't be afraid. Have the relationship with me in such a way that when I share with you something, you share it. Now, here's a thought. If you are not sharing what you're experiencing in your relationship with Jesus, it's one of two things. You don't have a relationship with Jesus, or you're afraid of what people will do. Verse 28, look at that one. Who on earth can kill your body? Who on earth can kill your body? Anyone. Now, it's illegal to kill you and eat you, but people still do it. Okay? They still do it. But who can kill your soul on earth? No one can kill your soul. No one. As a matter of fact, the only person that can harm our soul is who? Ours. Us. We harm our soul. And when we live such a life in which we've rejected Jesus all of our life, when we die, Jesus says, I want to give you what your soul desire was on earth, and I'm going to allow you to place your own soul where? In hell. And so as I think about this concept, according to this verse, who can kill your body and pass judgment on you to place your soul in hell? Who? Only God. He can pass judgment on you. So then when we live, think about this, when we live in reverent fear of God, we maintain a relationship with God, enabling us to develop compassion. Folks, it should scare the daylights out of us that we can send our soul to hell. It should scare us. That God can judge us. So here's a thought. Maybe a prayer time for us this week could look like this. Let's read it together. God, I'm often more concerned about pleasing people than you. How does fearing you please you to develop compassion in me? Love that. 3, compassion is developed by trusting God valuing me. This is really important. Compassion is developed by trusting God valuing me. I look in Matthew 10:29-31. Are not 2 sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. You know what I learned about people? Is people want to be cared for. People want to be cared for. Now, I've heard some people say, no, I don't need to be cared for. No, you're lying. People want to be cared for, and they want to know they are cared for. You know, what I'm about to say is a little awkward for you, because it's not awkward for me anymore, but a year ago, Stephanie and I came to you, matter of fact, a year ago this Sunday, came to you and shared with you the trouble that we were having in our relationship. It was a challenging time for us the past year and a half. And as we sensed that year and a half, then our family has gone through lots of things with our family, and things that we've been gripped with as far as our family and our past and our issues that we deal with. And in my own personal experience, I personally have felt this year fear and pain and feeling very alone. Yet, I have found in my experience as we've gone through my family issues, our marriage issues, my personal issues, that some people really resonate with me. I can think of one person in particular in our congregation, and every time I spoke to this person, no matter what I was dealing with, this is what this person consistently said. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't get judged. I didn't get looked down on. I just had someone in my life who was speaking words that meant a lot to my heart, which was simply, I'm sorry. A voice of compassion. Now, God knows this about me, and I think he knows this about you because he made you and I both. God knows that we want to feel cared for and cared about. And when God allows you to experience someone in your life who can say, I'm sorry, guess what you begin to know about you? That you have value. That people care for you. That people actually genuinely listen. And God knows that. And sometimes God does one of the best things that I needed was actually have someone on earth who could say that. And so folks, a thought here is we learn our value when we experience the compassion of Christ. We learn our value when we experience the compassion of Christ. And when we experience our value through the compassion of our God, guess what we can do to others? We can show them compassion. We can do the same thing. So a prayer today. Let's read this together. God, how does the experience of you valuing me help me be a compassionate person? Oh, I love that question. 4, to confess Jesus as my Savior is to know his compassion. To confess Jesus as my Savior is to know his compassion. Matthew 10, 32 to 33. Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven. You know, a couple Friday nights back, SCC had a taco night. And it was pretty well attended. We had a good taco night. It was a good time, taco night. And our hostesses that night were Marcia and Jackie. And they were kind enough to suggest to get a food plate together for the kids, because Jacob and Molly, because they just had Paisley. Actually, Molly did, and Jacob watched. But anyway, they had a good time in putting some foodstuffs together, and I had the benefit of delivering the foodstuffs over to the kids. The next day, Molly came to our house with a grievance. She came to our house with a complaint over the food. And I said, really, what's going on? She goes, well, Jacob hid the cookies. Now, there are some things that we're known for in a congregation. You know, some things that we're known for in a congregation. And this particular week, because of that meal time, you know, Molly got a meal this week from Jackie Ridge, and her favorite meal from Jackie is Jackie's pork chops. If you hadn't had that, get sick real quick, and she'll make them for you. Another one in our congregation is Marcia. Marcia's two foods are what? Cinnamon rolls and cookies, okay? Now, I can't repeat everybody here in this room what they're known for. I'm sorry, ladies. I'm not trying to offend you. I'm just using this for a story, okay? So please don't fire me after church. However, one bite of that cookie and Jacob was hooked. He hid the cookies. They weren't going to be anybody else's except Jacob's. He hid them for himself. He did not want to share. He was stingy with the cookies. Okay, that's how he wanted it. They were good. You know, it's a lot like that with Jesus. You see, if you've tasted the goodness of Jesus, can you hide it? Really, folks, can you hide it? You see, if you've tasted the goodness of Jesus, you can't hide it. You can't deny it. Matter of fact, there's one thing you want to do is you actually want to share it. And the thought for my thought process is if you have not shared the compassion Jesus has given you, then it's likely one or two things have happened. You have not experienced Jesus' compassion for giving your sin. Or two is you are more afraid of people than you are grateful for the compassion of Jesus. That's a big one. You are more afraid of people than you are grateful for the compassion of Jesus. This next verse, this next question is not a question, it's actually a statement, and there's an exclamation point after it. So let's have some emphasis on this, okay? Here we go. Jesus, you saved me from my sin, saving me from hell. Your compassion for me amazes me. Great one. Compassion compels me to sacrifice, just like Jesus. Look in verse 34. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will what? Lose it. And whoever loses life for my sake will find it. I think you probably can get this. This is a church crowd. Church crowds are probably pretty good at this question I'm about to give you. And let's see how you do with it. What did Jesus give up? His life. Okay, that's a typical church response. That's not a bad one. It's not all of it. I think we just say easy. Jesus gave up his life on that cross for us. I think that's easy. But what if we thought a few things differently? Jesus sacrificed his heavenly home for the dirt and grime of earth. Jesus sacrificed his divinity for a time in diapers. Jesus sacrificed his reputation because he hung on the cross like a thief. Jesus sacrificed his family acceptance. His mom and his siblings thought he was nuts. And his brothers refused to believe in him. Refused. Jesus sacrificed his popularity. In John 6, do the math later. In John 6, he fed thousands of people. And by the end of John 6, he was down to 12. Thousands of followers, down to 12. Jesus sacrificed his dignity. Jesus was stripped completely naked. We have a too sterile look at what Jesus looked like when he was whipped, beaten, hung. He was stripped completely naked, publicly whipped, mocked, and executed. Did I mention he was naked? He sacrificed more than his life. He sacrificed so much more. And so when I hear Jesus, how he gave up so much for me, I have to ask myself sometimes, and I have a legitimate reason not to volunteer at church? And have a legitimate reason not to do something for somebody else, to help others, to sacrifice someone in a situation that maybe I don't want to be a part of? There's no legitimacy in my lack of help to other people as I consider what Jesus has done for me. And so I have to think even a little deeper. You see, if I'm unwilling to sacrifice out of compassion, have I experienced Jesus' compassion to sacrifice for me? If I refuse to give up something for Jesus, have I really considered what Jesus gave up to show me compassion? It really puts in perspective. And so maybe you and I can have a thought with Jesus this week. So let's read this together. Jesus, your sacrifice showed your compassion for me. How do I let your compassion compel me to sacrifice for you? Last point, here it is. Compassion compels me to serve just like Jesus. Matthew 10, starting verse 40. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. Anyone who receives a prophet because he is a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. And anyone who receives a righteous man because he is a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. Where are you serving? Where are you serving, and who are you serving? I look in verse 41 and 42. Jesus says we get something when we serve. What do you say we get? A reward. So what does that mean when I don't serve? I don't get a reward. Let's share Jesus this question here. Say it with me. Jesus, in John 13, one of the humblest ways you served others was washing feet. How can I serve you to show the same compassion? I was struck by her story this week. I was really struck. And some of you may go home and research this author, and if you do, I don't want a backlash in this respect. I don't know this woman's theology. I think it's a little bit questionable, but I know who she met. So what she chose to do after she met him is different. But how she met him inspired me in many ways this week. So I'm about to read to you a story of Annie Lamont. And Annie Lamont, how she came to know Jesus. And I'm going to ask you what stands out to you the most after we're done with the story. I got pregnant in April, right around my 30th birthday, but was so loaded every night that the next morning, first urine was too diluted for a pregnancy test to prove positive. I was often sick in the morning. On weekdays, I put coffee on, went out for a run, took a shower, had a coffee, maybe some speed, 1,000 cigarettes, and then tried to write. On weekends, I went to the flea market. I happened to be there between 11 and 1 on Sundays. I could hear gospel music coming from a church right across the street. Their church looked homely and impoverished, a ramshackle building with a cross on top, setting on a small parcel of land with a few skinny pine trees. But the music wafting out was so pretty that I would stop and listen. I knew a lot of the hymns from the times I'd gone to church with my grandparents or from the albums we had of spirituals. Finally, I began stopping at the church from time to time, standing in the doorway to listen to the songs. I couldn't believe how run down it was, with terrible linoleum, and that was brown and overshined, and plastic stained glass windows. They had a choir, five black women and one rather Amish-looking white man, making all that glorious noise in a congregation of 30 people or so, radiating kindness and warmth. During the time when people hugged and greeted each other, various people would come back to where I stood to shake my hand or try to hug me. I was frozen and stiff as Richard Nixon. After this, scripture was read, and when the minister would preach about social injustice and Jesus, which would be enough to send me running back into the sanctuary of the flea market. I went back to the church about once a month. No one tried to calm me into sitting down or staying. I always left before the sermon. I loved singing, even about Jesus. But I didn't want to be preached at about him. To me, Jesus made about as much sense as Scientology or Dowson. But the church smelled wonderful, like the air had nourishment in it, or like it was composed of these people's exhalations of warmth and faith and peace. There are always children running around or being embraced, and a gorgeous, stick-thin, deaf black girl signing to her mother's flashing fingers, singing to her mother's flashing fingers. I could sing better here than I ever had before. As part of these people, even though I stayed in the doorway, I did not recognize my voice or know where it was coming from, but sometimes I felt I could sing forever. A few months after I started coming, I took a seat in one of the folding chairs off by myself. Then the singing enveloped me. It was furry and resonant, coming from everyone's very heart. There was no sense of performance or judgment, only that the music was breath and food. Somewhere inside me that was stiff and rotting would feel soft and tender. Somehow the singing wore down all the boundaries and distinctions that kept me so isolated. Sitting there, standing with him to sing, sometimes so shaky and sick that I felt like I might tip over. I felt bigger than myself, like I was being taken care of, tricked into coming back to life, but I had to leave before the sermon. Meanwhile, my life was continuing. I had published 3 books by then, but none of them had sold particularly well, and I did not have the money or wherewithal to have a baby. The father was someone I had just met who was married, and no one I wanted a real life or baby with. So one morning, my friend took me in for the abortion, and I was sadder than I had been since my father died. And when she brought me home that night, I went upstairs to my loft with a pint of Bushmills and some of the codeine a nurse had given me for pain. I drank until nearly dawn. Then the next night, I did it again. And the next night, although by then the pills were gone. I didn't go to the flea market the week of my abortion. I stayed home and smoked dope, and got drunk, and tried to write a little. On the 7th night, though, very drunk and just about to take a sleeping pill, I discovered that I was bleeding heavily. It did not stop over the next hour. I thought I should call a doctor, but I was so disgusted. And I had gotten so drunk 1 week after an abortion that I just couldn't wake someone up and ask for help. Several hours later, the blood stopped flowing. I got in bed, shaking and sad. After a while, as I lay there, I became aware of someone with me, hunkered down in the corner. The feeling was so strong that I actually turned on the light for a moment to make sure no one was there. Of course, there wasn't. But after a while, in the dark again, I knew beyond any doubt it was Jesus. I felt him as surely as I feel my dog lying nearby as I write this. And I was appalled. I thought about my life, my brilliant, hilarious, progressive friends. I thought about what everyone would think of me if I became a Christian, and it seemed as an utterly impossible thing that simply could not be allowed to happen. I turned to the wall, and I said out loud, I would rather die. I felt him just sitting there on his haunches in the corner of my sleeping loft, watching me with patience and love, and I squinched my eyes shut. But that didn't help, because that's not what I was seeing him with. Finally, I fell asleep, and in the morning, he was gone. The experience spooked me badly, but I thought it was just an apparition, born of fear and self-loathing and loss of blood. But then everywhere I went, I had the feeling that a little cat was following me, wanting me to reach down and pick it up, wanting me to open the door and let it in. But I knew what would happen. If you let a cat in one time and give it a little milk, and then it stays forever. So I tried to keep one step ahead of it, slamming my house door whenever I entered or left. And 1 week later, when I went back to church, I was so hung over that I couldn't stand up for the songs. And this time I stayed for the sermon, which I thought was so ridiculous, like someone trying to convince me of the existence of extraterrestrials. But the last song was so deep and raw and pure that I could not escape. It was as if the people were singing in between the notes, weeping and joyful at the same time, and I felt like their voices or something was rocking me in its bosom, holding me like a scared kid, and I opened up to that feeling, and it washed over me. I began to cry, and I left before the benediction, and I raced home and felt the little cat running along my heels. I walked down the dock past dozens of potted flowers under a sky as blue as God's own dreams, and I opened the door to my house, and I stood there a minute, and then I hung my head and said, "Okay, I quit." I took a long, deep breath and said out loud, "All right, you can come in." What did you hear? Compassion. There was a time in my life, and I was convicted of this past week, that when I would hear something like that, all I would see was what that woman has done, not what Jesus had showed her. I'm changing. Lord, we love you, and it's because of you, Lord, that we get the chance to be here today. We've heard compassion over and over, Lord, several times in this text. And Lord, I'm just curious about that word compassion and what you would have us go through to know it so deeply, and what you would have others experience so they could see your compassion through us. I'm so grateful you're kind, Lord. None of us deserve it. Sure love you. Our last song I thought we'd sing together right now is "I Love You, Lord." If you want to stand with me, we'll just sing a cappella. If you have a decision you want to make for Jesus, let's talk about it. Maybe after church or whenever you want. I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice to worship you. Oh, my soul, rejoice. In what you hear, may it be a sweet, sweet sound in your ear. Amen. Thank you for coming. As you speak.